Good day, Vashon Mori Island. My name is March Twisdale, and I'm so glad you've joined us today here at our island's own Voice of Vashon on 101.9 FM, KVSHLP Vashon. You're listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, a conversation-style interview show highlighting authors from around the world who seek in their own creative way to inspire all of us to be the best we can be. And now, on with the show. All right. So, hey, Shay, I am so glad you were able to call in today. How's it going?
Good. Thanks for having me today, March.
I'm thinking it might be great just to have you sort of ground our listeners here and tell them a little about who you are, what you write, and we'll start there.
Yeah, I'd love to. So I am the author of two young adult books, The Wicked Deep and Winterwood. My debut novel was a New York Times bestseller, and it won the Oregon Book Award. My third novel releases this December, and it's an adult suspense fiction novel called A History of Wild Places. Very excited about that one. Mm-hmm. And I'm also currently finishing up a book that will come out next July, and this one is a sequel to the Nightmare Before Christmas movie, the Tim Burton classic that we all know and love.
Right.
And this story will be told from the point of view of Sally. And then I'm working on revisions for another young adult novel that's releasing November of 2022 called A Wilderness of Stars. And to round it all out, I am drafting my next young adult novel that will come out likely in 2023. This one hasn't been announced yet. And then also working on my next adult fiction novel. So a few things. I'm writing a few things right now.
Yeah, just a few things on your to-do list.
Well, a few too many, perhaps. I don't recommend anyone else do what I'm doing.
Well, you know, I mean, yes. I initially heard about you because A History of Wild Places, I think, was being talked about in Twitter. And then I went to the website and I was like, ooh, ooh, oh, oh. So tell people a little bit about A History of Wild Places.
So this novel is a little tricky to talk about without giving anything away.
Right, of course, of course. Sorry.
No, you're fine. You know, even when my publisher was working on the, jacket copy that will live on the book to describe what the book is about, there was a lot of back and forth because we wanted to make sure to tell you enough to pique your interest, but not too much that we give things away because it's a tricky novel. But what I can tell you is it's the story of a man named Travis Wren. And he is hired to find a missing woman. And her name is Maggie St. James. And Maggie is a secretive, reclusive, enigmatic author of children's books. And she vanishes. And so Travis, who is somewhat of a washed-up psychic, he reluctantly takes the case of finding Maggie. And he tracks her to a remote community in the Northern California wilderness. Mm-hmm. And this community has been really trapped in time, sort of untouched by the outside world since it was founded in the 1970s. And as soon as Travis arrives in this community, he promptly vanishes, just like Maggie. Mm-hmm. And now the story picks up a couple years later, and is told through the eyes of three residents within the community. And they try to piece together the disappearance of Travis and Maggie, and in the process sort of begin to unravel some of the secrets within the community and also really secrets within themselves. There's a lot of lies in this book, I'll tell you that, March.
Yeah.
Trust nothing.
Trust nothing.
Trust no one. Authors inherently are liars, and this book is a great representation of that.
Okay, authors of fiction. I'm not sure authors of nonfiction would agree.
Right.
They'd be like, wait, but no! Yeah.
Correct. Thank you for that clarification. Yes, it is important that we separate the two. Well, you know, when I wrote my very first draft of this novel, which I started writing this back in 2017, mm-hmm. and the initial draft of it, the first chapter started in the community, and the community in the book is known as pastoral. Mm-hmm. And I started drafting it taking place right off the bat within the community. And I realized that we needed some context, or we needed that juxtaposition between exactly with what you're saying, you know, that outside world and life within the community. And so we needed to see some of our characters existing outside that community so that we can really have that contrast between the two worlds. And that's really where that came about. And then, and even Travis, you know, his journey initially took place, he was already in the community. And again, I have to be careful here so I don't give anything away.
Yes.
But I ultimately then decided to change and have these opening chapters, which is really the first act of the book, takes place from Travis's point of view as him searching for Maggie and then ultimately finding this community. And that was, it was hard to write it that way, only because for the reader, you become invested in, you know, his story and him seeking out this community. And then we really take a big turn at the start of Act Two, you know, a couple chapters in. Mm-hmm. Suddenly we are now following the story through the eyes of these three residents within the community.
Yeah.
And so it felt like two separate books, that I had to actually start the book from scratch as soon as I began that second act, and introduce you to three new characters that the reader hasn't met yet. And so it really did feel like two separate stories in that way.
And I think readers have gotten we're pretty savvy, you know, because it's like, you're right, we'll get infested and we start attaching to our protagonist or whatever. And then when there is a sudden pivot and now we're being asked to come at it from another person's perspective, I think it is true that there can be like a little bit of a reader resistance, you know, but I think a lot of us understand at this point that the author did this for a reason, and probably a chapter and a half from now, I'll be really happy. So I'm just going to okay, fine then.
And you're right. It is, you're asking something of the reader, you know, like, I'm really sorry. I know you've invested all this time in these chapters in this character, but I'm going to ask you to start over with me. And trust me that this is going somewhere, and there's a reason why the story is told that way. And there is a deep underlying reason why the story threads happen the way they do. And I do like to give readers a lot of credit, like you're saying. You know, I think readers are often far more willing to go on a ride with you than sometimes we think when we're in the story.
Mm-hmm.
And just trusting that they're going to come along. You know, it's like I'm taking the reader by the hand and saying, hey, I'm going to take you to this really dark, scary forest, but trust me, it's going to make sense in the end.
And it's worth it.
Yes, exactly. Well, you hope that, you know,
yeah.
As the author, you hope that by the end, the reader goes, ah, yes, I'm glad I stuck it out. And I'm glad this ended how it did.
So would you say sometimes authors will sort of like bounce around a little bit as far as like the style or the tropes or the genre that they're working in, but very often they will not do that. They'll actually sort of stay true to their own nature. And your previously published young adult novels are clearly this is the wrong word, but a word like it is the correct word. There's a sinister element. There's like, but that's the wrong word. So what's the word that I'm looking for the element that is it mystery? But the mystery is wrong. Help me here.
Yeah, I don't know that I can help you. I'm struggling to think of what, you know, what is a good word to sum up sort of that tone or the mood perhaps of those stories. You know, they're darker stories. You know, they don't fall into that horror genre.
No.
But there is elements of like, you know, witchery and witchcraft happening. But in both those books,
But it's not witchy either. It's not like a witchy. It's more like, would you say you do like, it's almost like you do a deep dive into the human psyche?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I hope that that's sort of what happens with all novels, because, you know, authors are also often psychologists. We have to really understand how humans function and how we think. Both of those books, too, take place in very dark, moody atmospheres.
That's a good way to put it. I like that.
Yeah. I don't think I will ever write a novel that takes place in a city. I'm just very inspired by the natural world, and so that's sort of a theme that does run through all of my books.
Someone recently was talking about how readers of fiction in particular are basically, they want to participate in solving the all the questions that the book puts out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people want to be a sleuth along with you.
Yep, that's a great way to put it. And I love dropping little clues along the way. I love to leave breadcrumbs throughout the opening pages of all of my stories, and in hopes that you, the reader, will figure it out before I actually reveal it to you.
Right.
And that's the fun part. I mean, I love it both ways. I love when readers say to me, "Oh, I figured it out, you know, on chapter 3, I figured out what was really happening." I love that. And I also love when they didn't see it coming and they get to the big twist and they go, "Oh my gosh, it hit me over the head. I had no idea it was sneaking up behind me." And I love that too. You know, I love that each time a reader picks up a book, whether it's my book or someone else's, and they get to go on that adventure and that journey for the first time.
Yeah.
And I wrote that book once, and yet that story gets to be told over and over and over again, which is, that's part of the magic of books, I think.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, you're absolutely right. I don't think about that quite so often, but that is like so beautifully true.
Mm-hmm. All the lives that your story gets to lead. And I often think it changes and evolves, you know, as readers read a story over and over. I feel like that book goes out into the world and becomes something new, because the readers, they make it something new. They interpret it in different ways, and that's really beautiful. My job is to put it on the page, and then I sort of send it out into the world, and what happens from there is up to the book, not up to me.
Right. Yeah, that co-creation with your readers is...
Yes.
It removes some of that isolation that writers can sometimes feel. It's almost like you're talking to your future readers, you know, in the middle. You'll suddenly go, oh my gosh, you guys are going to love this. You know?
You're exactly right.
Yeah. And then you're sitting there going, with this anticipation of future people who are going to be like all wowed by something. Okay.
Right, exactly. Yep, because you're solo in the writing process, but you know eventually other people will get to dig around in this world with you. They're just not doing it quite yet.
Yeah. So you said that you are definitely a plotter. You mentioned not only are you a plotter, which might be part of why you're so successful at being productive with fairly short time periods, but also you said this book in particular, multiple perspectives, POVs, was challenging. So you want to share a little bit of how you tackled that, how plotting maybe helped, didn't help, yada, yada.
Yeah. You know, I have a deep envy for people who are pantsers, because I think it just sounds so beautiful to sit down and write without a real clear path of where you're going, but just to follow the inspiration. I mean, to me, that just sounds like bliss. It's not how my brain works, but I have a deep, deep envy and admiration for those who write that way.
Right. Envy.
Do you write
good
that
word.
Way, Marge?
You know, I look at my writing as being twofold. There's the writing I do in my head, and there's the writing I do when I sit down and actually am concretely creating it. And so for me, I'm a pantser in my head. I'm a plotter on paper or on the computer.
Ah, that's brilliant.
So I feel like I get to do it all, because I'm never constrained by my plots. If an idea comes to me, an inspiration, I always feel at this point, because I haven't gotten to a point where I have that scary point where you have 3 more weeks left and you can never change anything ever again. I imagine that is terrifying. But
right.
I had made some serious sort of changes on revision 3, 4. decided I hated those changes, went back to sort of the original plot line and polished.
Like a true author, yep. Uh-huh.
There you go. I mean, what was that, like 200,000 words at least that were written and thrown away?
So you are right on track.
Oh, yeah.
Great. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Joy.
That classic phase of writing, yes.
Yeah.
I know it well.
But I do feel like, I mean, that's where Jessica Brody's book, Save the Cat Writes a Novel, was really great. I was at the end of version 5, moving into version 6, and I was listening to her, and she's definitely has some plotter information in that book that's really helpful. And it gave me like a slightly different way of looking at the novel. And I got out my flashcards and I wrote out my entire window was covered in all the flashcards for exactly every piece. And I figured it all out. And that took 3 weeks. And then I was like, now I have it. So that was my plotter. I hold you in my hands and you cannot escape me. So
you're a pirate when you plot, then. Is that
yeah.
what I'm
hearing? No, I'm just like, all right, I've nailed you.
You know? Yep. Yeah. Well, that really is the brilliance with Pan. If you do it in a way that has a light touch to it, it can give you that roadmap without making you feel like you can't deviate from it. Because there's a lot of magic that happens when you're actually in your novel and you're writing the words, and sometimes your characters or the story reveals things to you in that moment that you never could have foreseen while you're plotting it.
Oh, yeah.
And so you have to give yourself that breathing room to be able to kind of sway in and out of your plot and the story as it lands on the page.
Or you wake up in the morning and you've had a dream and you're suddenly like,
Yep.
Okay, then, and there you go. That's not going away. It's happening. I got to go write it now.
Yep, you're exactly right. Yeah, you have to leave yourself some wiggle room there, to be able to add in that inspiration. Because I'm an obsessive plotter, March. It's rough to be me, I have to admit. I like to plot out the main plot points of my story on a whiteboard first.
Nice.
So the big highs, the big lows. I like to know the big major moments that I'm going to hit along the way and hopefully a general idea of what my ending looks like. And then I sit down and I write a full chapter by chapter outline just in a Word doc. And that's usually just a few paragraphs for each chapter. Here's what happened. Maybe I've got an inkling about what the dialogue looks like between characters. So I might jot a few of those notes down. Maybe I know it's raining that day. I put that in there. Mm-hmm. But really just a general sort of chapter by chapter outline. And then once I sit down to actually start drafting the book, I also create a very detailed, very obsessive-compulsive Excel spreadsheet where I keep track of every single scene. So this isn't even a chapter by chapter breakdown. This is a scene by scene breakdown.
Absolutely. And you're not alone. I mean, totally.
Okay, good.
Totally.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Because honestly, to me, a chapter should happen after the scenes are figured out. The scenes are so much more important. And then you figure out, do these two go together in this chapter? Do I need them to be separated? Do I need a linking piece? But the scenes, it's a book is scenes.
Yes, you are right. Absolutely. Yep. So yeah, you need to know. And for me in my Excel spreadsheet, I keep track of where each scene takes place. So if I go back and look through my Excel spreadsheet and I see that, well, gosh, a lot of these scenes take place at that cafe on the corner. You know what? Too many of them do.
Right.
So I need to actually move this scene, and I'm going to have it take place on that stormy, windswept beach instead. Mm-hmm. It gives you that sort of 3,000-foot view of your entire novel when you can see it broken out that way. Mm-hmm. I keep track of all the characters that are in that scene. What's the feeling or mood of that scene? Are people angry, fearful, happy, sad, whatever that emotion is too, so I can go back and look and see, well, you know what? People were really angry for about 4 scenes there. That might be a little too much. I should infuse some, humor in there somewhere.
So I could see totally how what you're doing is it's editing in advance almost or along the way.
Well, and it gives you a roadmap, but it forces you to really look back at that and say, but is that right? is that how this scene should take place? Or did you forget that that one character actually has a seasonal allergy to flowers? And if they were in that flower shop, they would be sneezing and coughing. And so the whole scene should not take place in that flower shop.
Or it should, because they're sneezing and coughing the whole time, right? Yes. You want that.
Right, exactly. But the point is to sort of force yourself to examine some of those elements and not just, you know, write on a whim and trust that it's going to work out, which sometimes does work, but it's nice to give yourself a way to really examine some of those things.
People will think that you write a book and maybe you edit it twice and then poof, off you go. Well, you know, a lot of published mm-hmm. writers are like, okay, I'm on revision edit number 27, which means I only have 5 more to go before it's going to be ready. So that's actually mm-hmm. a little bit more realistic. Sometimes that's because you're like, I'm doing the edit where I'm going to find that word that I use far too mm-hmm. often, and my job is to eliminate mm-hmm. the word. And then mm-hmm. there's the, I have to get rid of, what are they? Not adjectives, but, you know, L-Y. Mm. Where does it end with an
yep.
L-Y?
Yep.
Whatever those things are. Yeah. And then yep. you're like, now it's my, I want to track, is the tenor and the setting matching up?
Yes, exactly. Well, and one of the other components, to actually circle back to the start of your question, we were talking about point of view
right.
in the book. One of the things that I also keep track of is who knows what within the story, because there are several layers to writing, not just multiple point of view, but really even just if you had a single point of view. Mm-hmm. You know, there, and the layers are begin with, you know, what do my characters know about themselves and their world? Mm-hmm. Now, the things they know about themselves and their world might be lies or they might be the truth. But there are also the things that I, as the writer, know about my characters and their world. And I know things that perhaps the character doesn't quite know yet. You know, they might have a long-lost uncle that hasn't been revealed to them yet. They might have a wad of gum on the bottom of their shoe. They might be a sleepwalker who commits crimes at night, but they don't know this yet. I know it as the writer. Mm-hmm. And then the third sort of element here is there are also the things that the reader knows about the story
right.
that perhaps the characters don't know yet.
Wait, you're in third person.
No, this can be in first person as
okay.
well.
Well, okay. I mean, I would think that generally that's easier in third person for the reader to know something that the character doesn't. I suppose mm-hmm. it could be done in first. I'm trying to, mm-hmm. I always think of first is mm-hmm. where you're just in the shoes of the protagonist. So therefore, what they know, you know. How would you know something they didn't know if it's all told in first?
Well, so there are things, and I'll reference my first book, The Wicked Deep, where there are a lot of clues sort of strewn throughout, and that book was in first person. But there are certain clues that are happening around the story that the character is perhaps witnessing but has not pieced together yet.
I see.
But and, the reader yeah. is seeing these things happen in succession and is grasping them in a way that the character might not be.
You're waiting for the character to figure it out.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I love that. Yep. I love that.
Yep. And so as the writer, you have to keep straight sort of where everyone falls in this alignment, right? Like, mm-hmm. what does the character know in this scene? What does the reader know in this scene? What does the character know I might not want the reader to know yet? And when you talk about writing in multiple point of views, now that gets especially tricky because, yeah. you know, you've got a character in this scene who knows XYZ, but they don't know ABC yet. But my reader knows ABC. So as this character is discussing something, the reader is recognizing like, oh my gosh, I know what's really happening. This character doesn't. They're about to, you know, walk into this awful situation because I know what happened in the other point of view that I just read in the last chapter.
Right,
now, again,
right.
this all sounds very confusing, and it is.
Honestly, the idea of multiple POVs for me at this moment is definitely terrifying.
Yes. You know, I promised myself after I wrote History of Wild Places that I would not do multiple point of views ever again. I tend to break my promises with myself, so it will probably happen. But by the end of it, it was such a brain twister.
And your editor will be like, wait, Shay, no, honey, we talked about this.
We talked about this. We weren't going to do these multiple POVs anymore.
Not only that, I recorded the conversation because I knew you wouldn't believe me. Listen to yourself.
I know. Well, now I have this evidence, too. You know, I've just said it publicly, so.
There you go. I know.
I also told myself I wouldn't do any more twists in any of my novels. So this new book I'm writing right now, I said, no more twists. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to write just a straight, clean book. It doesn't have to flip on its head.
Right.
It'll be fine.
Right.
But I got to about chapter 4, and I just realized I can't do it.
Well, the twists
are fun.
Yeah, the twists are fun. So actually, I should remind everyone, if you've just joined us here at Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, I am talking with Shay Earnshaw, and we're discussing A History of Wild Places and several other books that she's written. And if you missed the beginning, or if you're actually like, get into the grocery store and you're going to have to turn off the car and walk away, you can go to marchtwisdale.com and you go to my podcast page and you can catch Shay's interview and everybody else's interview there anytime you want, 365, 24/7. So I actually wanted to mention for you, Shay, that I interviewed Michelle Segarra. Do you know her?
I don't know her personally, no.
She's written like close to 40 books. And
wow.
Some of them are multiple POV, others are not, but lots of series and all these different things. And she also really enjoyed talking craft during the interview. And then also Jessica Brody joined me on the show. So you could actually listen to her interview, you know, if you don't have a chance to, you know, or before you pick up, maybe, you know, Save the Cat. But that really, you know, the people who have come on the show have just talked about amazing stuff. And I think it's just, they're a lot of fun to listen to. And it's all, you know, you can throw on a headset, go for a walk and have your phone in your pocket and usually pick it up as a podcast that way.
And I'll tell you, March, as an author, you know, I don't think at any point in your career you ever feel like you've mastered the writing process.
Right.
And so it's always such a good idea to go listen to other people's process and how they write their stories and what they've learned over the years. And so I'm endlessly devouring shows just like yours and anyone who's willing to talk about the process. The risk I run is I will, you know, adopt a new method or process, which just makes mine more complex. And so I just keep adding to my process. But I do find it just so helpful to hear how other people write a book, because I think we're all still figuring it out.
Absolutely. I picked up on the Manuscript Academy. If you have not heard of them, they're really cool because they have like a membership aspect, which is $49 a month, which is a pretty big commitment. But prior to that, you can listen to their podcast for free. And they have like 130 podcasts or something at this point.
Wow.
So when I first discovered them, I was out in the desert all last winter, and I will be this winter. And I just started, I was like, well, I'm not going to invest $50 a month yet, but I'll go with the podcast. And they were brilliant. And by the time I got home, I was like, I'm ready to join up. You know, they do all this really cool stuff, this behind the scenes eye-opening, which is really helpful for someone who's still trying to get their foot in the door. You, of course, are there, and you have your agent, and you've got your books, so you're solid.
Such a good resource. It's just good to know that there's things like that out there, absolutely.
Yeah. So to make sure that we get into everything, I'm gonna take us sideways a little bit. Long live the Pumpkin Queen, coming out next year. And my first reaction was, okay, wait, they had to get permission from Disney to do this, didn't they? So please explain this to me, because I'm excited and totally in awe that you like are able to do this. Maybe you didn't need permission, did you?
Well, it actually sort of happened the reverse of that, which was Disney came to me and asked me if I would want to write the book.
Oh my gosh, that's so cool.
I know. Yeah, quite an honor to even be asked. You know, the story goes.
No, wait. How much jumping up and down and screaming did you do?
I did a lot.
Okay.
I did a lot. I didn't truly believe it when my agent forwarded the email on to me when Disney had reached out to, you know, ask me via her.
You're like, wait, it's April 1st. I'm confused.
I know. Yeah, it was pretty wild. I think I just, you know, emailed back in all caps, yes, exclamation point. I don't care what any of it looks like, you know, just, yep, I'll do it.
Wow.
So the story goes that Disney has wanted to do this book sequel for a very long time. And obviously, you know, you have to get permission from the man himself, Tim Burton. Mm-hmm. You know, he's always been resistant for good reason to have an adaptation, or not an adaptation, but a sequel to such a brilliantly done movie No pressure.
Well, wait, mention the movie that it's a sequel to. I didn't say that yet out loud.
Oh, yeah, sorry. The Nightmare Before Christmas is the movie. For those of you who know and love, I mean, it's such a cult classic at this point. I know. And so every year Disney approaches him and asks if they can do a sequel, and he turns it down. And this year, well, last year, at the start of 2020, they asked him again, and he said, all right, I'll let you do it. And which was a big deal. And so they reached out.
Someone got a nice bonus at Disney.
No, right. To get approval for that.
Yeah, right.
Oof, I know. Yeah. And so they, you know, reached out and asked if I'd be interested. And of course, you know, I said, absolutely. It wasn't until after I'd said yes that I went, oh my gosh, what am I doing? Because it is such an iconic movie and it's intimidating, you know, I want to do the story justice. You know, it's told from Sally's point of view, and I think she's a character who has always deserved her own story. It took a long time for her to get here, but she finally gets her own story. You know, it was such an honor to be asked, but I also knew there's such a strong, broad fan base for that movie, and you know, I didn't want to disappoint
anybody. Which is a little intimidating. Yay. And those people who are fans are usually like, can be hypercritical, so it's very brave of you as well to be willing to take this on.
Yeah, you know, it was a big ask. Whenever I wasn't working on the book, because the book is mostly done now, but whenever I wasn't writing it is when I got nervous, and I would think about, you know, these fans who rightfully so feel, you know, some ownership to that movie and to those characters, and they don't want to see those characters ruined in any way. But whenever I sat down and was actually writing the book, it felt as if Sally was there and she really took me by the hand and said, I'm going to tell this story for you. You just have to come along and put the words onto the page. But she really knew what her story was, and I just had to trust and go along. And so when I was writing it, I didn't feel any of that fear and anxiety. I could really feel Sally was there with me.
Right.
And obviously to get to write in Tim Burton's world, you know, he created this unbelievable world. And to get to go into it and really sort of root around in there was an amazing experience. Again, sometimes I felt like I wanted to tiptoe around and not mess anything up, you know, to muck anything up in this world that he's crafted. But again, when I was writing it, it really sort of came through me. And I also really know that, you know, there's a lot of different interpretations of different stories out there. This was mine, and I have to just sort of plant myself there to know that not everyone's going to love it. I know that, but I hope enough people really do and that it resonates with them. And I had to write it as true to myself and as true to Sally as it could be. I did so much Sally research.
I bet. Well, okay, so I've got three questions that are just jumping around inside my head like crickets.
yes, go.
First, if Disney approached him and he said yes, does this mean that they are hopeful/planning on optioning the story for another movie?
Well, great question. It sounds like it's up for consideration. I will say that.
Okay, cool. I catch the limits on what you can say. No problem. Okay. And then is there any chance that the reason Tim Burton agreed was because the person at Disney who approached him already had sort of their eyeball on you, and they actually said, look at this author, what she writes, this is who I would like to approach. Does this make you feel more amenable knowing who would be doing the writing?
I mean, I would love to think it happened that way. I have no idea.
Okay. All right.
That's a really lovely way to think about it. it's totally possible. But, you know, I really don't know. You know, he's read all of the versions of this book as I'm writing
that
them,
was question
you know.
Number three. Did you have any collaboration? Have you been able to talk to him, and or does he give feedback?
Right. So I have not been able to talk to him. I would have loved, especially when I was really early drafting, it would have been just really great to, you know, just pick his brain a bit more. It's also been a very long time for him since he worked on that book or that movie. So no, I have not talked to him, but he does get, you know, every version of the novel as I write it gets sent his way. and then comes back, you know, with approval to keep going, keep charging ahead. I also would have really loved early on to get, you know, get a bird's eye view of Halloween Town. You know, they constructed these amazing sets when they made the movie. And Tim himself actually has possession of all of those sets. They're not actually with Disney. And so it was a request that I had early on is, you know, can I get just some like detailed photographs or like, where is that set? I would really love to be able to see just the location of things.
Sure.
You know, how far is Jack's house from the fountain? You know, how far is Dr. Finkelstein's lab and observatory from, you know, all the different elements?
Because the movie is definitely not going to give you like that, you know, geo mapping view. And you're like, if I want to have her walk over here, what if she accidentally, I think it's around the corner and it's really 9 blocks away and I get it wrong?
You are exactly right. Yep.
Got
that's
it.
Exactly what I wanted to make sure that I had just as detailed as possible. Now, Disney was not able to get their hands on anything like that from Tim. You know, they sent me everything they had, any photographs they had. Thankfully, there is a lot of stuff online. There's some really wonderful fan sites that have some detailed, even renderings of Halloween Town. But even then, there was a lot of stuff. There's a lot of gray area, and I really had to just make some assumptions and best guesses about, you know, what is the distance or what is this surface made of? You know, what is this doorknob made of? Is this wood? Is this stone?
Which actually leaves you a lot of creative license.
For sure. But again, I would always defer back to, I don't want to get anything wrong.
Yep.
I want the continuity to be as exact to the movie as possible. And so I spent several months just doing research before I ever even started drafting, because I want to get every detail right. And thankfully, you know, now that the book is mostly done, you know, it goes back through Tim Burton's team. It goes through Disney's team. You know, there are a lot of eyeballs on it to hopefully catch any of these inconsistencies. Because that's a really important part of it, you know. But it was an amazing experience. I mean, I wouldn't change it for anything.
You know, that is, I asked Jessica Brody the same question. I was like, how did you get permission? Because Save the Cat writes a novel, is based upon the book. Either just Save the Cat is the original title of this book that was about how to do screenplays. And unfortunately, the gentleman who wrote that book passed away at an unexpected young age. And a group of sort of fans and people who'd worked with him, they sort of formed together to help keep his book alive, his mission of providing these ideas to people alive. And so Jessica Brody had been connected with that group. And then at a certain point, they all sat there and said, okay, well, the next step is we need to create one of these for novel writers, because novels are slightly different than screenplays. And so that was how she actually came into doing that, was like she was asked, you know. And so I think it's really exciting to remind myself, and this is what I'm looking forward to, is people feel like when I get published, what I'm going to look forward to is seeing my book on the shelf. Yes, that's a part of it. What I'm looking forward to is, even before my book is on the shelf, I'm looking forward to my team, you know, my professional community, my cheerleaders, my guides, you know, the people who are going to say, we believe enough in you, your vision, and what you're producing, that we're going to come along and say, yeah, let's help you grow that career. And I feel like it's a good reminder for beginning, how do I say it, yet to be published writers who are on sort of this side of that line of delineation, to be like, you know, there's this whole crew of people over there who you're going to connect with and get to know, and it's going to be like a whole beautiful community that you will get to partake in.
Yeah, so well said. And that's about being published now, is that collaboration. You know, getting to work with editors who are really good at what they do, and they can really help to push your craft even farther and really develop skills, you know, that I didn't have prior to being published. And so each book, I've learned so much, and I've worked with several different editors now. But even like you're saying, beyond that, you know, the bigger team, having an agent that really stands by you and is there to really support and push and encourage you, has been a lot. And then great publicists. I mean, there are so many people behind the scenes that really help make your book what it is.
Right.
And it's that collaboration that I think is where the real magic starts to come about. And I'll tell you, too, I remember so clearly sending out those query letters and, you know, wanting to be published for years. I mean, I wrote multiple books before I ever landed a literary agent. And I just can remember that feeling of like, it feels so close, you know, you're almost there. And I used to describe it like publishing was behind this massive wall and this giant glittering castle. And all of us aspiring authors were on the outside tossing our query letters over that wall, hoping that someone would pick it up and read it and go, yes, okay, this is the one. But they'd read and go, nope, not quite. They'd toss it back. And you'd go write another book and you'd send
right.
more query letters. And they'd go, nope, not quite. Toss it back. And eventually they'll pick up the right query letter, the right book, and they'll go, okay, you can come in. And then lower the drawbridge. Say, okay, come on in now.
You on your white horse.
Well, I was probably stumbling, dropping papers all around me, you know. Fumbling through. And then you get to, you know, experience that imposter syndrome. You step in there and you go, wait, was I really invited to this party?
Right.
And you know, suddenly I feel like maybe I don't belong here. They probably
right.
made a mistake. They didn't mean to let me in.
When are they going to
yes.
notice? I'm going to get kicked
yes.
out, I'm sure.
Yes, exactly. Just stand in the corner. Don't make a sound. Don't make any loud noises. No one will notice.
Right. Oh, yeah, the imposter thing. Yeah, that is a thing. Oh, my goodness
yeah.
gracious.
Yeah. There's a lot of emotions in being published, that's for sure. And then once you get in there, you realize it's not a glittering castle after all.
Yeah, and everyone still goes to the bathroom in the same way you do.
Yep, that's
pretty
exactly
much.
Right. And there's some rough and tumble alleyways, you know, in there. There's,
yeah.
you know, you get a little bruised up along the way, but it's also pretty magical. So I always encourage people, just keep going. You know, the only difference between you and someone who's published is they just didn't give up.
Right.
They didn't stop until they got there.
Right. And there's so many of those stories. It's really, that was one of the things probably that was really great when I would listen to the Manuscript Academy podcast. Was just how mm-hmm. often, it didn't matter if it was an agent who was going through queries, you know, and giving feedback on queries. It doesn't matter if it was an actual writer themselves, an editor, you know, all of them had their story of, you know, so-and-so
yeah.
who had queried me and it didn't quite work. And a year later, she queried again. I thought, oh, I sort of recognize her. And then I just fell in love with her, blah, blah, blah. You know, and they're all like, I'm so glad she kept going. I'm so glad this person didn't stop.
Yeah. And it always feels like it kind of happens when it's meant to.
Yeah.
You know, I've written enough books before I ever landed an agent that I'm so glad were not the books that I ended up getting published.
I hear that
you know?
A lot too.
Yep. Yep.
In fact, so I'm glad know, no happens. One's even seen them and they're in a shoebox.
Yes, right. Yeah, exactly. No one will ever see those. Those are buried out back in our yard.
Yeah, right. One day if they ever go digging for bodies, they're going to find boxes full of pages.
Yep, of old manuscripts.
I couldn't
go
burn
look
it.
In any author's backyard and yep, that's what you'll find.
Right.
Manuscripts.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
So
before we run out of time, I want to make sure we talk a little
yeah.
bit more about history of wild places because one of the things that influenced your just ideation maybe around this was that you said you grew up in a part of Oregon where how do you pronounce this? Rajneeshpuram?
Yep. Yep, you got it.
Really? Oh, look at me.
I mean,
yay!
Pretty dang close.
I'm
we'll
sure they
it.
Say it better than I do. But it was a commune founded in the 80s, and it says here it was recently documented in the Netflix film Wild Wild Country. But
yeah.
So that was just sort of something that was a part of your growing up experience via your community, and it got you thinking, apparently. So What is it that really like drew you to this intentional community aspect of the story?
Yeah, so I grew up not far from Antelope, Oregon, which is where the Rajneeshpuram community was established. And you know, at the time, it was in the news a lot. People were talking about this community. And if you want to know more, you can go watch that documentary, Wild, Wild Country, on Netflix. Really well done. And I remember, you know, one of the things I remember, my dad telling the story of the day he saw a fleet of Rolls Royces that were being driven out to the community for the leader of the community. And I remember thinking, I was so fascinated by the juxtaposition of that. You know, you had this community that was really living off the land. They were using subsistence farming, right, yet they had some of these luxuries. And as a young girl, I had a lot of questions around that. You know, what does that look like, a community like this? Mm-hmm. And in growing up in Oregon in the 80s, you know, I was exposed to just more of that natural living lifestyle, alternative communities. My parents called themselves beatniks, not hippies. I don't know the difference, but they would always correct people. We're not hippies, we're beatniks. Okay, I don't know what that means.
You're like, yeah, just listen to my parents. I'm going to walk over here now.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, having known a lot of people who lived in alternative community lifestyles, I have always really wondered, you know, is that type of lifestyle really sustainable? And I think, you know, communes are really interesting social experiments. You know, can a community really govern itself without corruption, without the failings of power and control? Or, right, you know, is humankind doomed to repeat these mistakes over and over, regardless of the structure of a community or its government? And I really sort of asked myself that question as I was writing this book. It was something I wanted to explore and see, is that possible? You know, in my book, I guess without giving anything away, you know.
Yeah,
you know,
tread carefully, you know, tread carefully.
Yes, yes. But I guess, you know, regardless of what happens in my book, you know, I hope that it's possible. I think humans do have the potential to live harmoniously with the land and with each other. Our track record isn't so great, but I do think it's possible.
You know, it's interesting. I homeschooled my kids. One of my reasons for wanting to do this was that I'm a history nut. And, mm-hmm, you know, my dad, that was his field of study at university. And I was
great.
Always really aware of the difference between that caliber of history and then what is produced in history textbooks for government schools. And
yes,
so I ended up sort of being the person who was sitting there and thinking, you know, and then I would go to like homeschool conventions and there'd be other historical books created by other people. But every time I looked at them, there was almost always sort of like a perspective, a bias, oftentimes a Eurocentrism. So my kids, it was really very much like just, we would get National Geographics from the 50s, 60s, 70s and just sit there and make collages and read. And I just try to like bring them all those different sources that you could verify, confirm, and be confident in, rather than trying to find someone else who had curated this historical answer to humanity for me in a single book. One thing we noticed was this real difference between pre-agriculture and post-agriculture when it came to how people sort of lived together and what they were more or less maybe successful at.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, when you look at the Bushmen of the Kalahari Desert and you witness, you know, their language has like no words for war, murder, you know, they don't even have it in their language. And that was, you know, hunting, foraging, moving, you know, so they didn't have time to sit around and actually, they couldn't go to war with the other tribes, you know, because if they did, and they're both groups of 42 humans, and you lose a third, you just might not even make it. You know, each person, each child born, the community looks to them wondering what gifts they've brought with them. How are they going to benefit the whole? You know, you're waiting to find out what they're great at. And then as you notice, you're like, this one really loves to work with his hands. So maybe he wants to be over here doing this. And so the children are looked at as like this treasure chest that we're waiting to open. And then you look at the perspective of schooling in a society like ours or like China or any of these types of, you know, larger cultures, And a lot of times you look at children as, are they going to fit in the box properly?
Yep.
You know, and so.
And if you're not, we're going to force you into it. We're going to jam you into that box if we have to.
Right. And we have plenty of resources, which means some people want to rob us because we're hoarding resources. And we have time and energy to create objects of war to go rob someone else. Whereas the Bushmen didn't have that.
Right.
You know, so I do find that when I look at as having helped create a co-housing community in West Seattle and having lived there and witnessed all of that, and it was 100% consensus community. So all decisions were made with 100% consensus for 6 years.
Wow.
It was really exciting for me to see it proven true that this could happen. 39 board members would show up and look at every decision, and everything got voted on. And if one person was uncomfortable, we came back to it until everyone was comfortable.
Wow.
So it's amazing. Totally possible. But even in a situation like that, it's still humans living together. So there you
go. And does that community still exist to this day?
It does. Apparently, my son just went over to West Seattle with his grandmother to go driving around and do some errands and things. And it was his idea to actually swing by. And that's where he was born. And he wanted to walk around. And we have his placenta was planted underneath this beautiful curly willow that he went and got a picture standing underneath this giant tree now.
Wow. Wow.
And we're, he wasn't born yet and he just turned 20. Oh, wow, that's amazing.
Oh my God,
I keep thinking like it just happened. Okay, then
wow,
I think
it's a
22 years ago was when we joined the community and started developing the plans.
Oh, that's incredible.
Oh, that's creepy. I still think of it as just having happened.
Oh. How many members do you think there are? Oh, no, you're not. How many members do you think there are at the community now?
Well, all the houses are still full. The community was designed around the primary ethic. All of these intentional communities usually have like something that is like their founding point of view or thing that brings them together. You know, for us, it was diversity.
Wow.
Yes, all the houses are still full.
Wow. That's pretty amazing.
23 units.
So beautiful. And that really sort of answers the question is, can a community like that exist? And clearly it can and sounds like is thriving.
It's still humans, but sure. you know, humans on Earth.
A day-to-day question to examine.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so we're close to being out of time here. Was there any one last thing that you sort of, I think you had like a, you may have already mentioned it was a piece of, I know. You had a piece of advice for writers that you like to throw out there.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, I always say I'm wary of giving writing advice because I don't want anyone to think that I know what I'm talking about because I clearly don't. But when people ask me, I always tell writers to write a bad book first because anyone can write a bad book.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about going through the process of writing a book from start to finish. And I think you learn something in that story arc, in that character arc, and you're able to look back on the journey and say, okay, there it was. There was the book I wrote. It might be terrible, but that's okay. Because first off, you can edit and revise a bad book. You can't edit and revise a story that only lives in your head.
It's true.
And, you know, there's a lot to be learned about writing several books to really perfect not just your craft and your voice as a writer, but figure out the process that works for you. And, you know, it's similar to if you decided you wanted to learn to play the piano. You wouldn't sit down and write chopsticks or play chopsticks once and then assume you're ready for the Philharmonic Symphony.
Right.
You know, you'd spend some time. You would make sure that you have honed your craft as well as you can. And I just encourage people to write as much as you can and write that bad book. Don't be afraid of it. I think we can sit and stew on sentence structure or the exact right way to describe a character when sometimes you just need to get it on the page. So just write a bad book. We can, any of us can do that.
I think that's And, you know, a person could actually sit down and say, yeah, I'm going to do this. I'm going to write a 40,000 word, really, really bad book that I'm never planning to query. In fact, I'm going to go ahead and make it just like totally, you know, I'm going to break all the rules. I'm going to do everything you're not supposed to do. I'm going to I'm going to take one chapter and decide to have a million adverbs just so that I get it through my skin, how horrible that would be. You know, you could make it a literal, it's like a college assignment, you know, where the only thing that's going to happen at the end is that you are going to grade your experience. And then who sits around with all those papers they wrote for all those college classes and has some expectation that anyone else on the planet is ever going to look at that paper that you poured your blood, sweat, and tears into and didn't sleep for, you know, 9 days to write it. But you got the grade and you went on to your next English class or your math class or whatever. And it's like that, you knew that was part of the process of developing your skills. So yeah, like, you know, that could be a NaNoWriMo plan. I'm going to write the worst book ever, but I'm going to do it in 1 month. And then I'm going to set it aside and be like, look at everything I learned. Now I'm going to go write that book that I'm in love with, that I really want it to be good.
Well, and don't we learn so much more from our mistakes in life than we do from the things we got exactly right? You know, if you were to write a book and you just nailed it from start to finish, you might look back and go, I don't know how I did that. I mean, I don't know how that came out so perfectly. But, you know, I've learned some of the biggest things from just making errors and mistakes in my novels. And you rest assured, when you make that mistake, you're never going to make it again.
I know.
Because now I've learned that lesson.
You do not forget that that didn't work.
Yep. You're not going to write yourself into that plot hole again.
Right. Oh, my gosh. Ouch. Shay, thank you so much, so much, so much for spending the last hour with all of us.
I had such a great time. This was such a good chat. I'd come back anytime.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, next year we can definitely do that. You've got two books coming out. They're both super awesome. And I hope to catch up with you in Bend, Oregon at some point.
I would love that. Thank you so much, March.
My pleasure.